Techtopia. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med mediehuset Ingeniøren, Automatikmessen Automatik, AM Hub og IDA Forsikring. Jeg hedder Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.
Techtopia. The world has a data problem. You all know about this, right? Human beings are shit at data. We're bad at it. There's too damn much of it. We just don't know what to do with it. They have to make up new terms. Right? In 2011, this only went to exabyte. We had no term for 1,000 to the 7th. A bunch of scientists had to get together and like, what are we going to call this shit? Data's growing really fast. They made a big mistake. They chose Z, the last letter of the alphabet, for zettabyte. And then they had to make up yottabyte. We're going to have to switch to Elvish or some shit for the next ones. Or we're just going to stop talking about it. But as humans, we've got a problem. We don't know what to do with all this data. So, what are we going to do to tame all this data? What's good at data? Machines are good at data. They're really good at data. They specialize in data.
Manden, der taler her, han hedder James Whittaker. Han lyder lidt som en stand-upper, men han er faktisk en helt almindelig hvid amerikaner på 50 plus fra sydstaterne. Hans titel er teknologiprædikant, technology evangelist hos Microsoft, og han talte om data på konferencen The Next Web i Amsterdam.
My name is James Whittaker. I'm a distinguished engineer from Microsoft. And I work in AI, and I work in the Internet of Things, and just go around the company doing interesting things, and it's a company that does a lot of interesting things, so we get along pretty good.
Whittaker skriver bøger om at lave præsentationer som en stand-upper, men denne sommer, der har han også udgivet en lille bog om fremtiden, som titlen er. Whittaker taler om forbindelsen mellem data, Internet of Things og kunstig intelligens. Ja, faktisk så vil han gerne gøre hele verden målbar gennem at reducere alt til data. Jeg mødte ham på festivalpladsen til The Next Web, hvor han spankulerede rundt i en t-shirt, hvor der med store bogstaver stod Do Epic Shit. Jeg bad ham om at beskrive sig selv som data. Hvilke data består James Whittaker af?
I'm a complicated set of confused data. You know, the idea of reducing the human to data isn't actually all that far-fetched. You know, our brains are our data, our body and the chemicals inside of our body are our data. And I don't think I'm answering your question.
You say the human is a complicated bag of data.
Yeah, so can we reduce it to data? Are you familiar with the Human Brain Project? It's a project going on over in Seattle. And so, you know, we've already reduced human DNA to data. We've sequenced the genome. And so now we're trying to reduce the human brain to data. And figure out, you know, how it works and where mental illness comes from, and can we detect the parts of the brain that suffer from depression and anxiety and bipolar and fix all of those things. And then recently I've been doing a health hacking project trying to understand, you know, what my youth bio, this is called biogerontology, the idea of understanding the aging process and reversing it. And that's what it's all about, right? Reducing the body to data, you know, the hormones and the liver enzymes. And, you know, if we end up doing this, this is where the fountain of youth is going to come from. Understanding how the data for our minds and the data for our bodies and be able to do something about it.
Whittaker, han har for nylig deltaget i et projekt om gerontologi. Det handlede om at reducere aldringsprocessen til data. Hvad er det, der sker, når vi bliver gamle? Og hvordan kan man beskrive det fysiske forfald gennem data? Vores genom i form af DNA, det er data, og det samme er vores hjerne og dens funktioner. Hvis vi vil bekæmpe sygdomme og i sidste ende måske finde ungdommens kilde, som Whittaker kalder den, ja, så skal vi analysere kroppens data.
You know, I'm not sure you asked the question for that sort of an answer, but the idea of reducing the human, you know, condition to data is actually quite interesting. Not only from a health point of view, but also from, you know, a teleportation point of view and being able to cast ourselves into, you know, a digital world. And so, you know, our CEO calls this digital teleportation. And, you know, the idea of being able to you know, I could be here sitting talking to you as a hologram, and my actual body could be back in Seattle, and the movements of my mouth and everything that I do in Seattle would be replicated here in holographic form. And so the idea of, you know, reducing yourself to data and then transporting you somewhere else, Star Trek, right? The Princess Leia putting the you know, programming R2-D2 as a hologram. So, you know, this is the point I made in my talk yesterday, is the world is being reduced to data. And when I say that, I'm literally talking about everything. The world, our environment, you know, Hawaii beaches can be reduced to data. The red light district in Amsterdam can be reduced to data. And then it can be experienced anywhere you are on the planet. So the idea is the data underlines all this, but AI and machine learning and virtual reality and augmented reality are all going to be a layer that sits on top of the world's data.
WeTaker bevæger sig unægteligt hurtigt i abstraktionsniveauerne fra sundhed til evig ungdom til teleportation. Hvis vi skal kunne teleportere som i Star Trek, så skal vi reducere kroppen til data, og det samme gælder, hvis vi skal optræde som et hologram, ligesom prinsesse Leia i Star Wars. Så der er unægteligt mange muligheder, hvis vi reducerer kroppen til data, både i den nære fremtid og så ude i den her science fiction fremtid, som man nogle gange havner i, når man taler om teknologi. Men konklusionen er, at alt i verden reduceres til data, så det kan læses af maskiner og opleves gennem augmented reality eller virtual reality som et ekstra lag ovenpå verdens data.
It certainly expands the possibilities. You know, we are far beyond the development of websites and apps. And we are moving into a world where we're building things on top of data. And presently, that's a huge challenge. And so this picture I paint is sometime in the future, but it's certainly currently a challenge because the web is such a poor organization of the world's data. You know, you search for something simple and you get 13 million, you know, blue links and page after page of links. That's not sufficient. And it's going to take AI to tame that. It's going to take a view of the data that's different than just searching for strings in a file, searching for relevance based on, you know, voting it up and voting it down, links in, links out. AI is going to fundamentally reshape the way we think about the web, fundamentally reshape the way we handle data. AI can handle data, right? Machines that we program are going to be really good at data. Humans are really terrible at data. And so, you know, we're facing a future where the machines are actually going to be better at navigating the world than we are.
WeTaker mener, at vi er langt forbi tiden med websites og apps. Det er ikke interessant mere. Nu skal vi bygge med og ovenpå data. Men når man skal søge alle de her data, så er nettet en rigtig dårlig måde at gøre det på. Så vi skal bruge kunstig intelligens til at skabe orden i vores data. Maskiner er bedre til at overskue og organisere data end mennesker er, så de bliver bedre til at skabe mening og struktur i verden, mener WeTaker. Og det bekymrer ham faktisk.
We are the first generation smart enough to create machines more intelligent than ourselves, and yet stupid enough to actually create them. And that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be building machines because we have to. If I want to understand my own health, that's a lot of data. My own brain function, that's a lot of data. My DNA, that's a lot of data. What's good at data? Machines are good at data. And, you know, even, you know, finding something to do last night in Amsterdam, I was looking for a barbecue place. And we were talking earlier, I'm from, you know, Kentucky and Tennessee. Barbecue's a big deal. And I've been over here for a month and I haven't had good barbecue. And so, you know, I'm Binging it and I'm Googling it. And you know how I found a great barbecue place? I just happened to walk by it, right? It was just a complete and total accident. And it's that's because they have a website that I couldn't find. They didn't advertise, and therefore, you know, it didn't get voted up in the search engine process. And it's crazy that, you know, it takes serendipity to find these things. And it won't in the future because, you know, as cities come online, tonight there's a, here at the Next Web, there's a Smart Cities Symposium. Should be really interesting. The idea is that all these, instead of building a website, instead of building an app that represents your company, represents your restaurant, represents your business, you will have digital presence as data. And so, you know, you will be broadcasting the fact that, hey, I'm a barbecue joint in downtown Amsterdam. And then when I express my intent to have barbecue, those two pieces of data will meet, and discoverability will be much, much better. I mean, that's really the problem that we have. It's a discoverability problem.
Vi er den første generation, som er fiffige nok til at kunne bygge maskiner, der er smartere end os selv, men vi er også dumme nok til at gøre det, siger han i bedste stand-up-stil. Men vi har brug for kunstig intelligens til at overskue de kæmpe datasæt, som for eksempel menneskekroppen består af. Og så har vi et problem med at finde ting og steder i den fysiske verden. I dag er søgefunktionerne på nettet simpelthen ikke gode nok til at gøre det præcist.
The machines are going to do a lot of this. And in general this falls under the Internet of Things umbrella. And so we're experimenting with this at Microsoft, putting our conference rooms on the Internet of Things, putting our parking garages on the Internet of Things, putting our cafes on the Internet of Things. And so the cafe knows it's a cafe. And the cafe watches its activity. There are sensors in the ceiling that figure out how long the lines are in each of the different food stalls. There's also, you know, we know how many orders have been placed. That's data. We know which orders are being worked on, which orders are being fulfilled. That's data. We know how many people are in the cafe at any given time. That's data. We know whether or not the seats, how many seats are free, how many tables are free, how many tables have been cleaned, how many tables haven't been cleaned. It's all data. So you can literally walk up to the cafe and say, I only have 20 minutes, which line is going to serve me within 20 minutes. And so that's data. We'll know what's the shortest line. And we could even know, you know, because this is Microsoft, whether every employee has a badge, we would know maybe that your dining preferences, and we know maybe you're gluten-free or vegetarian or whatever. And so all that could be taken into account as well. And so the same idea with a city. You know, if you say I want a beer and I want a place where I can sit outside and maybe there's a happy hour. And so the brewery or the bar that has a happy hour, that has outdoor seats that are available, will then connect with you and say, oh, well, I can fulfill that intent to have a beer outside. And so that's the idea, right? Every object in this future will be self-aware. A bar will know it's a bar. A parking garage will know it's a parking garage. And they'll be capable of monitoring their own data. So as soon as you pull into the parking garage, the car will communicate directly with the garage, lead you to a parking spot that's free. And that's the idea of turning everything into data. You know, AI and IoT really can't be separated. AI has to have a place where it can do some its work. And that's a machine, and the machine needs, you know, intelligence in order to be able to operate. So AI and IoT go hand in hand.
Hvis man ser verden som bunker af data, der kan analyseres og præsenteres som brugbar information for os mennesker, ligesom Whittaker gør, så kan maskiner gøre rigtig meget for os. Whittaker taler om Internet of Things, hvor rum som caféer og parkeringskælder samler information om, hvad der foregår i dem, ved hjælp af sensorer, kameraer og data fra kasseapparater. Målet er, at man i stedet for en ineffektiv Google-søgning skal kunne spørge sit apparat om nærmest hvad som helst. Hvor kan jeg få serveret en glutenfri øl på en udendørs café inden for de næste 20 minutter uden at stå i kø? Det kunne være et eksempel. For at lave den søgning i datahavet og komme op med et brugbart svar, så har vi brug for Internet of Things og kunstig intelligens. Men hvis det her skal virke, så skal data om rigtig mange ting, også private forhold, flyde gennem dette datahav, så hvad med etikken?
Here's where we could really screw up the future. You know, as we reduce things to data, if we reduce our own human biases to data, if we reduce our own racist and sexist attitudes to data, we're going to create racist and sexist bots and robots and AI. And we have to be really careful, you know, not to do that. I was in a meeting yesterday, and it was all male, all a bunch of white guys. And so if you know, I took that as data, you know, okay, you know, what how do I find an expert on, you know, AI? If you look at that room full of AI experts, the AI would go out and find another man, another white guy. And so that's a bias that, you know, we as humans currently have, and we have to be careful to remove that bias from the data set before we train the AIs. And so ethics, how do we train an AI to, you know, to be reasonable and fair and not inherit the biases of humans is a huge field, and we need more people thinking about that. We can't screw this up. Understand that AI is fundamentally different than every type of programming we've done in the past. In the past, we write code, and that code does a very certain specific task. AI is different than that. We don't write the code. We train the AI. Here's the data. Find these answers and figure these things out in the data. So it's non-deterministic. We don't know what the AI is going to do. It depends on the data that we give it. It's going to behave differently. And so we got a chance now to do this right. If we screw it up, that AI will continue to operate based on, you know, bad data, unethical data, and, you know, we might lose control of it.
So it's a garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad data in and unpredictable behavior out. And the idea of unpredictable AI is terrifying. You know, right now, the way we write our apps, we know what they're going to do. We don't know what AI is going to do.
Her kan vi virkelig lave lort i den, lyder det meget direkte svar. Hvis vi for eksempel reducerer menneskelige relationer og fordomme til data, så kan vi nemt overføre racisme og sexisme til robotter og kunstig intelligens. Vi skal være forsigtige, siger Whittaker, da dagen før havde været til møde med en flok af kunstig intelligenseksperter. Hvis en kunstig intelligens skulle analysere rummet som den eneste datakilde på, hvordan eksperter i kunstig intelligens ser ud, ja, så ville den lære, at eksperter i kunstig intelligens, det er hvide mænd. Derfor handler det om at træne sin kunstige intelligens på data af ordentlig kvalitet. Før i tiden skrev man kode, i dag træner man neurale netværk, og det giver andre fejlkilder. Dårlige data giver uforudsigelig kunstig intelligens, og ingen ønsker sig en uforudsigelig kunstig intelligens. Men er der slet ikke noget i verden, som Whittaker ikke mener kan reduceres til data? Menneskelige følelser for eksempel. Og her får jeg så et been there, done that svar.
Well, I mean, human emotions can be reduced to data as well. You know, we have this Project Emo we're working on it at Microsoft. A few friends of ours, me and a small team, built this at part of our hackathon week in 4 or 5 years ago. And it was on my phone. It's been sitting on my phone for all those years. And my father died last year, and it detected my grief. I had forgotten it was on my phone. I got a call from Manos. He's, you know, like, hey, you know, I'm getting grief signals from your phone. Are you okay? And I'm like, wow, my father died, you know. It knew. And so we're actually really good at detecting emotions and, you know, taking the what's going on in your face right now and figuring out, are you confused? Are you happy? Are you sad? It's all data.
How did your phone know about this?
Well, I mean, the prototype app was on my phone, and it was looking at me through the camera. And of course, you know, if you've ever had somebody close to you die, you get a lot of texts, you get a lot of calls, you spend a lot of time staring. Because I'd gotten off the plane in London, my father died in Kentucky, and so you know, I see, you know, 270 texts. That never happens to me, and so I spent a lot of time, you know, scrolling through the texts and replying to. So that camera had a lot of time to look at my face, and determine the grief emotion. And so it's actually, you know, when you begin to convert things to data, you realize sometimes it can be pretty easy. Our faces can be very readable. And the machines are going to be really good at that because they're going to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of pictures of people experiencing grief, and they're going to find the pattern. Hundreds of thousands of people experiencing happiness, and they're going to find the pattern. And it won't just be the cameras looking at it. It might be, you know, some wearable that is able to take my pulse and maybe even like a blood sample. And you know, we're going to know really quick what's wrong with you. What kind of emotions are you experiencing? And so the real interesting question here is what can't be reduced to data? And so if human emotion can be reduced to data, if our brains and our body's health and all of these things can be reduced to data, you know, what can't? Because, and we need to come up with an answer to that, because that's what's going to be left for us humans once the machines do everything else. What can't be reduced to data?
Vi har reduceret følelser til data på en hack week, siger Whittaker, hvor vi byggede en app, som tog fotos af smartphone-brugere for at analysere dem med henblik på at identificere sorg og glæde. Men Whittaker blev selv ramt i nakken af appen, da han havde glemt, at den lå på hans telefon. Den holdt stadig øje med ham, da hans far døde. Whittaker var ude at rejse og læste en masse beskeder på telefonen om farens død, hvilket udløste en sorgmeddelelse på telefonen, som blev sendt til hans kollega. En alarm om, at James Whittaker er i sorg. Du må hellere lige tjekke op på ham. Det skræmmer nu ikke Whittaker, der også i fremtiden vil forbinde wearables til appen, så man kan måle puls og måske tage blodprøver, og bruge det som data til at beskrive ens humør. Men hvis der nu slet ikke er noget tilbage, som vi ikke kan reducere til data, vi kan reducere hjernen, kroppen, helbred og følelser til data, hvad er der så egentlig tilbage til mennesker?
If we continue to reduce the human equation to data, the really interesting question is what's left? You know, what doesn't reduce? And so this is kind of existential, but you know, if we reduce the entire human to data, and we there's still something left, that's the consciousness, right? That's the soul. We might actually discover the fingerprints of God because we can't reduce the entire human equation to data. Whatever is left is going to be consciousness. It's going to be our soul. It's not going to be data.
Vores sjæl, Guds fingeraftryk. Whittaker famler lidt efter svaret. Og inden vi bevæger os alt for langt ud i det metafysiske rum, ja, så vælger vi at tale om jobs i stedet for. Er der overhovedet arbejde til mennesker i datadrevet samfund, hvor kunstig intelligens skaber struktur og overblik?
Humans over the next, you know, 10 years are going to have a couple of jobs. One is going to be building these machines, right? So if we build machines that replace lawyers, there's going to have to be some subject matter experts, some lawyers who help, and then some people who can code. And then, you know, the accountants plus people who can code are going to reduce accounting to data. The stockbrokers plus people who can code are going to reduce finance to data. And so, you know, that's going to be a human activity that you're going to be able to get paid for the next decade or so. And then there's people who, you know, curate and inject data into the ecosystem. They're going to get paid. And then there's going to be people who do the things that the machines can't do, the things that we either haven't yet to be reduced to data or can't be reduced to data. And I think that's one of the most existential questions that we face right now as both citizens and computer scientists. What can't be reduced to data? And it's something about creativity, right? We can train an algorithm to do a one-off of a Rembrandt, but we can't train an algorithm to paint something from scratch that's as good as a Rembrandt. We can train an algorithm to play chess really well, right? So well that a human can't beat it, but we can't train an algorithm to create a new game that's as interesting for humans to play as chess. And so there's this creative element that I think is going to shift society. Right now we spend a lot of time training our kids on, we call it STEM in the U.S., science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The machines are going to be really good at all that stuff. The stuff that they're not really good at, the creative arts, we're going to have to get better at as humans.
Der er jobs til dem, som bygger og koder maskinerne og fodrer dem med data. Og så er der de jobs, som ikke kan reduceres til data. Og her fokuserer Whittaker på kreativitet. Kunstig intelligens kan lave kopier af kunstværker, men teknologien kan ikke skabe banebrydende ny kunst fra bunden på egen hånd. Så de kreative fag, de skal styrkes, mener han, fordi det er der vores fremtid som art, den ligger. Sidste spørgsmål er naturligvis, hvem kommer til at kontrollere et datasamfund?
Well, I think it's wide open right now. I mean, I don't know even if I can't even count five. You got to look at the cloud providers as, you know, the major cloud providers as the obvious incumbents for not only storing but, you know, manipulating and processing this data. And then from all the major cloud providers, you've got to subtract the people who aren't good at AI. And so you end up with a few companies who are really well positioned to be the, you know, utility companies for this new for this new ecosystem. And so, you know, will another company come up? You know, you look at companies like Tencent and Alibaba in China, and you got to say, hey, they got a shot at this. And, you know, Microsoft and Amazon and Google, they got a good shot at this. And the companies that don't have the cloud infrastructure and don't have the AI expertise, they're going to have to get it. Could it be a startup from scratch? It's hard to imagine because of this cloud infrastructure is expensive, and there's a lot of companies that have a huge head start. Or is something fundamentally going to change the game, right? If you think about the 90s and all the big cable companies that were stringing fiber across the world, and then all of a sudden you think, oh, well, there can't be another one because all this fiber is too expensive to lay, and then wireless comes out. And now all of a sudden the fiber is not so important anymore. Like, I remember building a house in the 90s, and one of the line items on it was, you know, Cat 5 cable throughout the entire house, fiber optics throughout the entire house, a little server room that I needed. I don't have any of that in my new house. It's all wireless. There's a wire coming in and that's it. So could there be a technology that comes along and, you know, like quantum computing, that completely displaces the need for all these massive energy hogging data centers, and now you've opened it up to, it could be anybody. Future is going to be really exciting.
Ja, hvis man skal komme med et godt bud på fremtidens forsyningsselskab, så skal man kigge på de store cloud-firmaer, som også er gode til kunstig intelligens. Og så ender man med ganske få virksomheder som Microsoft, Google og Amazon, eller Tencent og Alibaba i Kina. Men teknologien er dyr, så det bliver nok ikke en startup. Men vi har før set ny teknologi ændre alting meget hurtigt. Så måske kunne ny teknologi som kvantecomputere ændre alt.
Stay tuned and hang on tight.
Thank you.
James Whittaker's Little Book of the Future, den er udkommet, og jeg linker til hans website fra tektopia.dk. Lad os slutte med en bid fra hans foredrag, der handler om, hvad der sker, når man gør sit badekar til en del af Internet of Things, så man kan tjekke det, mens man er ude at rejse. Måske ikke en ubetinget god idé.
And then there's things. Let's talk about things, right? And when I think of things, I think of my hot tub. And I don't know why. I miss my hot tub. Now, European peoples, chill out for a second, okay? I'm not boiling my children in my tub. This is Fahrenheit. It's a thing we do in the U.S. just to mess with the rest of the world, right? We like you to come to our country and be confused. It makes us feel superior. So a couple summers ago, I decided I'm going to put my hot tub on the Internet of Things just to see how hard this is, just to see how available the hardware is. And so the idea is reduce the problem to data. And so the first data is, of course, water quality, the sensors. And this sensor that's shown here is a $39 sensor. It dangles three sensors in the water, and it computes water hardness, which is calcium, chlorine, which is bromine, and pH, and there's an algorithm to compute alkalinity from pH. In four lines of code and $39 spent, all of a sudden my hot tub is collecting all the water quality data that I will ever need. All of a sudden my hot tub is capable of figuring out which chemical lasts the most and costs the least. I could never figure that out. I bought the cheapest. My hot tub started buying the second most expensive because it was actually the best deal. The answers were in the data, right? The data about me and my daughter, my son, who are the primary users, the data about which of us leaves behind more undissolved solids. Go on, guess who it is of the three of us. Go on, guess. This appalls my daughter because it's her. She's the dirtiest one in the family. I'm sorry, sweetheart, this is data. But she's the dirtiest because she wears makeup and hair product and lotions, and me and my son don't bother with all that stuff, right? And so all of a sudden this data just starts coming out, right? Now I've got a little mechanism for it to inject it in, and it noticed that every time I put in chlorine, I took the lid off. So it started opening its lid. It's a little motor on there, $50 motor. And injects the chlorine and waits for the chlorine to evaporate and all the organic compounds to escape, and then it closes the lid. Pretty freaking cool, right? I figure out what human's in there with another sensor. This sensor was $17. It goes from the bottom of the hot tub to the top of the hot tub, and when you sit in the hot tub, right, your mass displaces water, and I know somebody's in the hot tub, so I don't close the lid on, stuff like that, right? I don't inject chlorine when a human's in there. Right, it's pretty cool. And then it noticed that I displace more water than my son, who displaces more water than my daughter. And now, based on that water displacement, I can identify who is in my hot tub, which is pretty handy. Oh, I did. I got a notification from my hot tub. In fact, I was here in Amsterdam. My hot tub's in Seattle, 4,000 miles away, right? And I get this notification. My hot tub's like, dude, there's 305 pounds of human flesh in me right now. That's what it calls you if I haven't told it your name, right? 305 pounds. And I'm thinking, 305 pounds? Who's in my hot tub? Why didn't I install a camera? And then I thought, well, maybe it's two people. Yeah, you got it, right? I subtracted my daughter's weight. And I got Dylan. Dylan! If it had been 10 pounds lighter, it would have been Kevin. I'd have been fine with that scenario. I like Kevin. Dylan, not a fan. And I'm like, shit, I'm 4,000 miles away. What can I do? And I realized I have only one feature that could help. I did it. I'm a terrible father. I'm like, fucking close lid, right? And 5 minutes later, I get a text from my daughter. She's like, daddy, the hot tub's going crazy. And I said, no, sweetheart. You triggered the chastity protection feature of my hot tub. It's amazing what you learn based on data. I couldn't have figured all this stuff out. My hot tub can. The machines are better at us when it comes to data. The answers are in the data.
Du har lyttet til Techtopia, som bor på techtopia.dk og udkommer hver mandag. Du kan møde næsten 1000 andre Techtopia-lyttere i vores gruppe Techtopia Backstage på Facebook. Du kan følge podcasten på Twitter på @techtopia.dk, og du kan sende mig en e-mail på henrik@techtopia.dk. Må dine data være med dig på genhør. Techtopia. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med mediehuset Ingeniøren, Automatikmessen Automatik, AM Hub og IDA Forsikring. Jeg hedder Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.